I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. I have, as it happens, only one friend who is Russian. Do you, by any chance, happen to have a Russian friend, or two, or three, or four, maybe more? My friend happens to be married to a man from Haiti, who is also my friend. And so my situation with these two people, and also, I guess, their marital story, these are stories of intercultural bridging, cooperation, accommodation, all of that good and important work that people do in order to understand and value each other. People are different, after all. And difference, some people call it tension, well, it's at the heart of every good, engaging story. My Russian friend has lived now many years in the United States, as has her husband, actually, so they're both American, but they're also Russian and Haitian. Their daughter is a playmate with my daughter. I admire and respect this beautiful family. Now, think for a moment about somebody you possibly know who's different from you because they've emigrated from their place of origin. And if you would, keep that person in mind as you meet our next guest on Constant Wonder, an immigrant who tells her story exceptionally well. When that Aeroflot plane, she writes, took off on October 19, 1989, from the Moscow Sheremetyevo airport with me and my parents on board, I had only one important objective: to stop being Russian. Well, how successful can a person ever be in trying to become something completely new, leaving a former identity, the old self, behind? I think this is perhaps the pivotal question of her collection of essays. It's titled, I Named My Dog Pushkin and Other Immigrant Tales. Margarita Gokun-Silver is a freelance writer and novelist. And when she isn't writing, you might find her creating paintings which have been published in literary and art journals. It's a pleasure to have her with us to talk about her life experience. Margarita, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You know the story of trying to conceal one's heritage or mother tongue or any hint of origin, national, ethnic origin? I think that's kind of an awful but very, very common story based maybe in fear. And I don't know what your motives were, but you actually wanted at some point in your life to conceal where you came from.
Yeah. No, I tried really, really hard. I worked very hard on getting rid of my Russian accent. I do still have an accent when I speak English. People do kind of say, huh, you're not a native speaker, but not a Russian accent. And I basically tried to leave behind every single bit of my Russian identity as much as I possibly could when I first started this whole immigration journey. So, yeah, and that's basically my story. And then I came back to accepting some of it back. So,
yeah.
Came full circle.
Some of it, you say. Let's go right back to the beginning of your desire to leave what was formerly called the Soviet Union. So you say you came in 89 from Moscow. And that's right around the time when, you know, all hell was breaking loose politically in Europe and in Russia and elsewhere. Was that a time where it was easier to get out, to leave your homeland?
So, yeah, we left in 89. We applied to leave in 88. And this was sort of the second wave of Jewish immigration from the Soviet Union. The first wave went in 79. The second wave was negotiated by Gorbachev and Reagan and started sort of at the end of the 80s. So we applied in 88. It took almost a year to get that exit visa. And we took off in 89, but we didn't get to the States until 1990, because in those days, you don't immigrate directly, or you didn't immigrate directly. You went through several countries to get there. And it was basically because the agreement that I think they reached between the Soviet Union and the U.S. Is that Jews would be allowed to leave, but the Soviet Politburo, or the leaders, they didn't necessarily want it to make it easy. So they said, okay, fine, you want to leave, so you're only allowed to go to your ancestral homeland, which we consider Israel. And of course, Soviet Union did not have a relationship with Israel at that time. So the planes did not go directly to Tel Aviv, and they went through European countries. So American agencies, Hebrew Immigration Aid Society and Joint Distribution Committee, got together and sort of devised this little plan of how to get the Jews out, but not necessarily for them to go to Israel, because a lot of those Jews that were immigrating at the end of the 80s had relatives who left in the 70s, who were living in the US and Canada and Australia. And of course, when you're immigrating into a new culture, you want to join people that you know. You want some advice. You want a cup of tea. So we all got invitations as if we were going to Israel. Our invitation read we were going to go to Israel. We would board a plane that would take us to Vienna and declare to the Soviet authorities that in Vienna we'll change and go to Israel. But then, you know, it'd be a person meeting us at the plane and blankly asking us, you going to Israel or you going somewhere else? And if you were going somewhere else, you were kept in Vienna for a couple of weeks, and then you were sent to Italy to process your refugee status with the American authorities. I don't know why, but Rome was where they've set up the interviews, the Immigration Naturalization Service of the United States. And then you had to wait to see whether or not you got your refugee status. You got tested for AIDS in those days, you know, 89, 90, that was also raging. So I guess they didn't want anyone who was HIV positive coming into the country. And then you waited. And if they granted you refugee status, you waited some more. In our case, we waited a lot more because our relatives in Los Angeles at the last minute decided not to help us come in. We were going, hoping that they would, but they said, oh, our circumstances have changed. And it had nothing to do with money. It was just basically welcoming you into the country. So we had to wait and see if a Jewish community elsewhere in the U.S. Would open their doors for us. And we waited about 6 months, 5 to 6 months, and ended up in New Hampshire.
You know, that is a long journey with a lot of different stops along the way. And I'm just wondering if you were feeling a little bit kicked around.
We were. And also, we were stateless. In those days, if you left the Soviet Union as a Jewish immigrant, they took away your passport. They took away your citizenship. So you were no longer even Soviet. So you had no nationality. You were under protection of no state. I remember the train journey from Vienna to Rome. It was just, I write it in my collection, it was just so bizarre, especially for Soviet Jewish immigrants, many of whom, they were older people, they still remember World War II and the Germans coming in and killing everybody and the Holocaust. And here you are, you're being stuffed into a train, literally like sardines. And there were German-speaking Austrian police guards at the end of each car with big machine guns, either guarding us or hoping that we won't jump in the intermediate stop. And then, you know, at the end of the journey, you get to a station outside of Rome, and you basically spend a whole night sitting on top of your suitcases because there's no other space. And when you get to this tiny station outside of Rome, they tell you, oh, you've only got 2 minutes to leave the train. So the picture you want to picture is just evacuation. Like there was a bombed out train during World War II and you evacuated, you pass children through the windows, you throw your suitcases. It was complete mayhem. And, you know, for us, people who grew up with an understanding of World War II and appreciation of what happened on the territory of Russia and also what happened to the Jews, that was just like, oh, my God, what's happening here? And then to culminate with all that, you have a person who is supposed to organize us, and he comes in and he's wearing all leather. And that's what we remember seeing that Nazis were wearing in all the movies that we watched in the Soviet Union. Mm. And he starts screaming at us in Italian. We don't understand a thing because, you know, none of us speak Italian. I do. So my parents actually forced me to translate. But it was just this moment of, why are we doing this? Where are we going? Who is even going to want us if this is how it's all starting?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was a little interesting, yeah, to say the least.
I want to go back now to the time period in your life before this. And you've mentioned now the Jewish background, and you've got the Russian background. And where was the main loyalty or the main identification for you growing up? Was it, I am Russian, I am Jewish, I'm both? How did that work for you?
Well, I was never allowed to call myself Russian. In fact, when I got to the U.S., that was the moment when people started calling me Russian. But in Russia, I was not Russian. I was a Jew. And it was written in every single document I had. So if I were to call myself a Russian, people would laugh at me. So my identification was pretty much okay. I'm a Jewish Soviet citizen, and I live in the Soviet Union, but I'm not a Russian. And so, when I got to the States and people would say, "Oh, you're Russian," I would always correct them. I'd say, No, I'm from Russia, but I'm not Russian."
Yeah, but you were successful in school at some point in hiding that and posing as a Russian.
Yeah, well, unless they look in the teacher's journal or some other document, they didn't know by the way I looked or by my last name, because my last name was not Ashkenazi Jewish. It was Sephardic Jewish, and for the Russian ear, it didn't sound Jewish. And so, yeah, I got really, really good at hiding. Unless someone saw my documents, nobody knew that I was Jewish. Yeah.
Yeah. So sometime in your life, in your early life, you determined that you wanted to go to America. And I guess the other people around you also, whether they were Jewish or Russian ethnically, many of them had to attest a certain loyalty to the Soviet Union and not get in trouble, but they all wanted to go to America.
Well, I mean, yeah, because it was a prohibited territory. Everything was painted by our press, by our Soviet press, as terrible in the United States. And since we knew not to believe the Soviet press, we figured it was all great. And everyone was dressed nicely. And there was music, great music coming from there. There were so many bootlegged, American singers that we listened to. Bruce Springsteen, definitely among them. So, yeah, everybody loved the United States.
Now, at some point, you with your parents have to come to some decision. I don't know how you worked it out, but did you persuade them? Did they persuade you? You wanted to leave, and it also has to do with your training to become a doctor.
Yeah, I persuaded them, basically. When Perestroika came about and glasnost came about, there were all this lots of bigotry just started appearing everywhere, and it just became not only unpleasant to be a Jewish person in the Soviet Union, it was kind of feeling to be unsafe. And I thought, why would we stick around? And so I started trying to convince my family, and my dad is not easily convinced, which is understandable. He was in his early 40s, mid 40s, and to completely change everything, from the language to the culture to the economic system, it must have been an unsurmountable, it just seemed to him an unsurmountable task. So it took me about a year, but I was really lucky because my grandparents were supporting me and my mom was kind of, teetering in between. And of course, my winning argument was, well, look, I couldn't become a doctor here because of the Jewish quotas, but I will become a doctor in the United States. There are no quotas. And so in the end, they left for my future. And in their idea of my future, being a doctor was firmly included. Yeah.
I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. We're having a conversation with Margarita Gokun-Silver about her collection of essays. It's titled I Named My Dog Pushkin and Other Immigrant Tales. Margarita, you come to the United States, you get through that awful long period of months on end, wondering where will you eventually land. And you do say you arrived in the United States, you say in New Hampshire?
Yep, we flew into Manchester.
And you didn't have anybody to greet you from family, relatives, none of that was you were, I guess, people without a home, but without much else either.
Yeah, we actually did not know anyone. We didn't even know where New Hampshire was when we first got news that we were going to New Hampshire, because in the Soviet Union you maybe hear of New York and Los Angeles, but New Hampshire, no idea whatsoever. And so yeah, we landed in the middle of the night, and people who met us were the members of the Jewish community of the synagogue that offered to take us in, and they took us to our first apartment. And they helped us settle. They helped financially. They paid for the apartment for the first couple of months. They helped my dad with his resume. They really helped me because I wanted to continue my education. And when I heard the tuition rates, I literally was like, what? Because, in the Soviet Union, everybody went to school for free. And so what they did was they helped arrange for grants and loans with a local liberal arts college. So I was able to actually continue and finish my bachelor's degree there.
And did not become a doctor.
Did not become a doctor. I did do pre-med, but then In the middle of that, I remember it as if it was yesterday. I walked into a first class on endocrinology, and I sat there and I listened and I understood nothing, even though my English level at that point was really, really good. And I was thinking, I looked around myself and I'm like, all of these people really want this. Why am I here? I don't want this. This is not something I want. Why did I move to America to pursue somebody else's dreams? And that means my parents' dreams. And so I just walked out. I dropped endocrinology. I kind of segued my way a little bit outside of pre-med. And yeah, I never went to medical school.
Tension with your parents over this?
Oh, a lot of tension. They were at that point in Ohio where my dad got his first job, and they just couldn't believe it. They were like, how could you do this? You were supposed to consult us. You were supposed to talk to us. We were hoping you'd become a doctor. You'd follow into your grandmother's footsteps. And to mention a little bit, that's the grandmother who died 10 days before we left, who was supposed to go with us and then had a stroke and died. And so it was paramount to my mother, it was her mom, that I would follow in her footsteps and sort of honor her. And also my mom wanted to be a doctor, but never became one. So it was kind of her dream. And yeah, there were a lot of tensions, which is why I decided, okay, I'll do something in the medical field, maybe compromise will work. So I did my master's in public health, but I'm here to tell you that kind of compromise does not work with Soviet-born parents.
Well, this is getting to the crux of a theme that I introduced earlier when we first were getting going here, which is the idea that you wanted to change who you were. You wanted to leave a lot of stuff behind from your culture, even the heritage of certain expectations of your family. And I'm going to just jump ahead and kind of, you know, cut to the chase here, which is that at some point in your life, you started seeing in yourself some aspects of your parents that you had rejected. I mean, the idea that you would be in control of you know, a child, that's you didn't get away from being Russian completely, did you?
No, absolutely. I remember that it was with my daughter, right? Because, I mean, in the Soviet Union, you parented by being very critical and judgmental and, you know, expecting that your children are supposed to do as they're told. And I realized when my daughter hit her teenage years that I was channeling my parents and how they did it. And it hit me over the head, really. And she's also helped. She's called me a Russian mother several times, which we laughed about, or, you know, but I, you know, deep inside, I was horrified. And so I realized you can't get the Russianness out of you. Yeah, you can take a girl out of Russia, but getting the Russianness out of you?
Well, what aspects of your Russianness did you really feel that you were going to succeed at dropping?
I did not want to be critical and judgmental. I wanted to be able to give my daughter the opportunity to decide for herself. I didn't want to control her. I wanted her to sort of choose her own, but all of that other stuff was just coming out. And of course, it wasn't helpful that my mother was in my ear, you know, constantly saying these things. And I was doubting myself. Am I doing it right? Am I embracing this new mode of parenting? But what if? And so, yeah, it was a complete mess for a few years.
Don't you have some kind of a feeling that there is a parallel situation in the political environment of the USSR, the very controlling society? But I don't know if that's a manifestation of an older culture. All of this issue of control and then your views of America being a place of openness and freedom and liberty and all of that. I'm just wondering if it wasn't just your family, but you were also trying to leave behind the political heritage of that you grew up with.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. And I think, you know, there's a saying that Russians always say, oh, we will always have a czar. We will always be under control of someone. And you can see this in the progression of the history. You know, you first had the czar, then he was deposed. You had the Soviet Union, but the Communist Party was the new czar. And then we see the dawn of democracy and boom, you've got Putin and now he's the new czar. So, yeah, there's I think the control is embedded maybe in the culture. And that's also manifests itself in how parents parent their children. Yeah.
So there are aspects of being Russian that are sort of the outward trappings, what you wear, what you eat, your accent, And then there's sort of an inner characterological kind of inheritance too. What was most worrisome for you, the way people saw you as you appeared on the outside, or kind of divesting yourself of these inner tendencies?
I think it was the inner tendencies that I wanted to divest from. The way people saw me didn't really matter, because no matter what I did, I think a Russian can see a Russian from 5 miles, because we have these expressions in our faces that are like hardened. But I think the inner tendencies of, you know, being critical and being judgmental and not being open-minded, which is kind of what I grew up with, and not just in my family, but also in the society, that's something I really wanted to divest from, and I worked hard to get rid of those, yeah.
But how idealistic were you being there? Because over the years in the United States, certainly you found out that those are not uniquely Russian traits. There's a whole lot of that hardened, judgmental, critical aspect right here among people who've been here for generations.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you can't just say that only Russians are judgmental. And I've lived in many countries and you can find judgmental people everywhere. But I think for me, it was important to eliminate as much of that as possible. I'm not saying that I'm completely clean slate. I'm sure there's some left over, definitely. But for me, it was important to just, you know, to try to be open-minded and see people at what they are and their intentions, you know, that they are good, or that, you know, there's a certain reason behind their intention. Then, you know, I'm not the one who's supposed to tell them how to do things, which is how we grew up. So, yeah, I've worked on that.
Well, there is also part of your story that has to do with incredible ambition and kind of a pie-in-the-sky view of what you might be able to accomplish professionally here in the States. And this leads me to the story of the screenplay. Mm-hmm. You wanted to have Bill Clinton advocate your screenplay to Steven Spielberg.
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, it's one of these things, I think, also that somehow is a leftover from the Soviet upbringing, because you grab an opportunity when you can. And by opportunity, I mean, maybe a kilo of clementines or butter. You know, you just never know when something may appear somewhere, and you really have to grab this opportunity. And so in the very beginning of my public health career, I worked in Uzbekistan and I met Hillary Clinton. I ran a sort of a roundtable for her with women NGOs. And when I started writing, I figured, well, why not? I can just, you know, write to Bill and see, if, you know, because I've met his wife for exactly like 5 minutes, you know, maybe he can introduce me and this screenplay would be of interest to Spielberg. And I mean, you know, it's a fascinating story of the screenplay. It's about my great-grandmother getting lost and her whole family leaving to go to Argentina in 1916 and her staying behind and having to live in the Soviet Union. I mean, it's a fantastic story of a Jewish diaspora and Jewish escape and immigration. But obviously, you know, it was probably not the way to go.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't going to work necessarily, you know, a one in a million chance. But what does it say about you that you would jump at that opportunity and hold that hope?
I take my chances everywhere they come. My husband makes fun of me a lot. He says it's not realistic. And I say, well, one can dream. And so there are sometimes amazing synchronicities that happen because I take those chances. And I've learned from just little things happening that you always have to try, because you'll regret not trying. It may come to nothing, but it may come to something.
I want to talk with you now about how, after spending a lot of years trying to doff the trappings and the inner aspects of your coming from Russia, at some point you start to realize that there's things you want to retain from your heritage. What did you finally value and say, oh, that's for keeping?
Well, a lot of these things had to do with food and culture. So we ended up living in the newly independent Russia in 2000, from 2005 until 2009. And so, you have access to all of the ballets, all of the concerts, all of the operas you can ever have access to. And I took my daughter to all the theaters. I introduced her to dance classes, music classes, art classes, everything I had access to as a child, and everything that is extremely high quality in Russia. And I also introduced her to my childhood foods. And that's where I stopped drinking coffee with breakfast. And I rediscovered tea because I was always a tea drinker in the Soviet Union. But then when I got to the States, it was coffee all the way. And so I've discovered that, you know what? I still like my certain Russian foods. And I still like to celebrate the New Year's Eve the way we celebrated it in the Soviet Union. And I still like my movies, my old movies, and I'll watch them once in a while. So I think a lot of what I came back to do have to do with food and with the culture I grew up with.
The puppy dog, Pushkin. We have to talk about the dog. It's in the title of your collection. And
Yeah.
I'm wondering if this dog, first of all, tell us the story of the dog. And then I'm wondering if this dog somehow represents part of what you've learned about yourself, about being Russian, about being American, about going back and then revisiting the past.
I think maybe to some degree. We got him when we were living for that work in St. Petersburg in 2008. We got him. And we got him because my daughter really wanted a dog. And we got a little Maltese because she's allergic to other kinds of dogs. And when we were wondering what to call him, one of her little classmates said, "Oh, well, call him Pushkin because it's connected with the city. It's just makes sense." And we said, "Yeah, it does." And so we called him Pushkin, and we immediately got scolded by, first of all, babushkas on the street if they heard us calling him Pushkin, but also Ileana's music teacher. And she was like, "How could you? He's a revered poet. He's, so important. You can't call a dog with that name." And that's when I realized that, I was no longer Russian by belief in those things. Like, I didn't feel that it was super disrespectful the way she felt. I felt completely the opposite. I felt it was a fun name to give a dog. So there was kind of like a joint in between there, me being an American and thinking, yeah, what a fun name to give a dog, right? And also wanting to pay dues to his Russian heritage as well, my Russian heritage, but he was born there too. And so, yeah, that's, I think, sums it up perfectly.
You know, Americans are very well known for their irreverence about things. We're the kind of people who cast off the past, and we're very interested in what is novel, what is innovative, what the future will bring, what youth are doing. And so we quickly want to divorce ourselves from the past. And I'm wondering if you've become a little bit irreverent because there you are feeling like it's not disrespectful to take one of the greatest poets from Russian history and give that name to a dog.
I don't know. I think I still have a little bit of that Russianness of nostalgia in me. I still do think about the past. Like, if you play a song from my childhood, I may actually cry. So, and also as a Jewish person, for me, memory is important. And remembering what happened to people in my former country, to Jewish people in my former country, to my grandparents, my great grandparents, is important to me. It stirs a lot inside me. So I don't think I completely disregard the past, but to me, naming a dog after a poet is not disrespectful. I mean, it's not naming a dog after a tragedy. It's naming a dog after somebody who is dearly beloved.
Do you see your life experience and this transition and all of these questions of identity and heritage, do you see them as being something that is transferable to somebody else, to somebody who might have a completely different experience but also be grappling with who they are and what they should value and who their ancestors are and if all of that matters?
I think so. I mean, I've received lots of emails after the book came out about people saying how they could relate, even though they may not be themselves immigrants, but maybe children of immigrants, or if they are immigrants, they're immigrants from a completely different country. So I think a search of identity, like a mix of cultures and trying to figure out who you want to become, who you are in the process is very relatable to pretty much anyone out there, I think.
Have you been able to put down roots so firmly that you can call your current abode a real home?
No, because of my husband's job, we've actually lived in so many countries now that I think my time outside of the United States has been much longer than my time in the United States. So I'm still searching for that abode, actually. And that's, I'm starting to write a newsletter trying to see if I can figure it out by just questioning every single month as to what my home will be. But yeah, it's been actually tough just because I immigrated here, but I haven't really spent that much time here aside from going to school and coming back, you know, for a couple of years here and there.
Margarita, I enjoy your story so much and your life experience. I'm so glad you were able to share some of it with us. Thank you for being on Constant Wonder.
Thank you for having me.
Margarita Gokun-Silver, she's author of I Named My Dog Pushkin and Other Immigrant Tales.
In just a moment here on Constant Wonder, another tale of becoming American. BYU Radio's Sam Payne will talk about his own Greek family heritage and the role that food played in his childhood.
You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Time for a good story from Sam Payne of the storytelling show The Appleseed. The Appleseed features storytellers from around the world. Lots of stories, some funny, some adventuresome, some heartwarming. I think we can sneak in a few heartwarming stories on The Appleseed from time to time. New episodes on BYU Radio Monday through Saturday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific time. Sam, welcome back.
It's great to be here and absolutely heartwarming. Boy, that's our stock in trade.
Good, good. I thought I might begin with a burning question for you, if you think you can handle one.
I'm ready for it.
If you think of our mother tongue and all of the trouble that has arisen over that squabble, tomato, tomato, that's nothing compared to the endless confusion about gyro versus gyro.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's true. Yeah,
nobody says gyro.
But some people are not at all confused. I, for example, am not at all confused. I'm very confident in the pronunciation of the sandwich that I enjoy, which is the gyro sandwich.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But there was a time. There was a time when I was ordering gyros.
And, were you?
Yeah, yeah.
You shouldn't have been, because I know a little bit about your heritage. You actually – if you have a hankering for a gyro, yeah, you come by that hankering very legitimately.
I hope so. Yeah, yeah. My mother's family – well, my mother's mother is Scandinavian, but my mother's father, my grandfather, is Greek.
And whoa. Because you go up north and it's cold and dark.
That's right.
And you go down to the Mediterranean and it's bright and warm.
It's true, yeah. They both wound up in Duluth, Minnesota of all places. But yeah, there's enough Greek – to almost entirely eclipse the Scandinavian in the family.
There's, you know, those tussles.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, I remember learning a little bit about my heritage. You know, we were at a family reunion, and my son, who's now a grown-up person, you know, but when he was a kid, he asked my grandfather for the family story, in particular some of my grandfather's World War II memories. My grandfather fought in World War II. And the family story spilled out, and it was a wonderful couple of hours in response to my son's question. But it reminded me of a time when I was in high school and I started to get some of the family story. And it had to do with – well, I was in a foods class. I was a senior in high school and I was in a foods class, and I had only taken the class really as a way to fill a required credit, and I don't know how much I was looking forward to it, but almost immediately I was won over. We learned about cooking temperatures and about keeping food preparation surfaces clean and about how to properly wash a dish and about why you include certain ingredients in baked goods. You know, some of it was like sciencey. It was kind of a sciencey class, and some of it was like a health class, and some of it was like living in the school cafeteria. I remember watching a video in class about how to frost a cake. You know, this was way, way before the great British baking anything, you know, and I was mesmerized. I learned about buttercream frosting and, oh man, I better stop there because I got to finish this story and, well, my mouth is beginning to water. But I found in that class that making food was something that I wanted to be good at, right? Which is why I lost so much sleep over the final assignment of the class. We were supposed to make an entire gourmet meal all from scratch for our families. Our families are going to eat these meals. And we were to choose the menu items and we were going to prepare them and we were going to present them and we were going to photograph them and we were going to eat them. And then we were going to come back to class and talk about them. And we knew about the assignment from the beginning of class, but I fretted over it like it was the ACT test, you know, and I was a procrastinator of the first order, and I didn't get any relief really until my mom just had the idea. She said, "Why don't you make one of your grandmother's Greek dishes?" Well, my great grandfather was an immigrant from Greece. My grandmother, as we mentioned, was from Scandinavia, but she had learned to make all those Greek dishes, right? And as a kid, my great grandfather had lied about his age to get a job on a ship, and he came to America on that ship and stayed. He fought for the United States in World War I as a draft replacement for a friend of his who would have had to leave a family, wife and children, to go fight in the war. And my great-grandfather, brand new to the country, had volunteered to go in his stead. He was unattached and went and fought in World War I. And my grandfather, though he had been born in Duluth, Minnesota, and not in Thessaloniki, was every bit the Greek that my great-grandfather was. And though my grandma's people were Scandinavian, as we said, and not Greek at all, my grandfather's home was a Greek home, as we said. And my Scandinavian grandmother made all the food, you know, that my Greek grandfather loved. Well, I didn't know any of this. And in those days, I lived in an American middle-class town in an American little middle-class way. I was pretty much like every other kid in my American middle-class school, learning the American middle-class stuff that all of them were learning, you know. And I didn't think much about my heritage. But then came this meal. My grandmother lived 700 miles away, and calling in those days on the phone was expensive. This was before cell phones. This was in the days of the TV commercials that encouraged you, in spite of the expense, to reach out and touch someone, right? And so I called my grandmother. But it first meant starting with a letter. I wrote a letter asking my grandma if she'd help me make a meal, and then came a letter back with ideas for menu items and lists of ingredients. And on the day that I made the meal, I held the phone under my chin. I stretched the long phone cord over to the kitchen counter and to the stove and the oven as my grandmother gave me tips about how to make the food of my family. And with making that food came stories. I got the story of how my great-grandfather got here on that long ago ship. And I learned stories about the branches of the family that are still in Thessaloniki at the foot of Mount Olympus. I learned about my family name, Pappas, a name shared with so many Greek immigrants, even though they're not related to each other, because it was a general abbreviation from their real names, which often came from the priests of their congregations, Papadopoulos or Papastefano, or in the case of my family, Papavasiliou, all of them shortened to Pappas in America, right? Well, my grandmother taught me about oregano and rosemary and lamb and olive oil and olives and cheese. And her daughter, my mom, taught me about honey and phyllo dough and chopped pistachios as she showed me how to make baklava, laying down layer after layer of paper-thin dough and nuts and honey and butter, and then in the end, cutting the finished baklava into diamond shapes. This was more than a meal. And when I was done, I was filled with the stories of my family. I was connected to my heritage in a way that I never had been before. I saw things about the relationship between my grandparents that I had never seen before. I saw things about their relationship with my mother that I had never thought about. And of course, the next time I looked in the mirror, I saw things I had never thought to look at before. I saw the shape of my nose and the thickness and color of my hair and the line of my jaw all as meaning something, you know? And the food, by the way, was great. The kitchen smelled – well, it smelled like my grandma's house. I remember my mother leaning over the pans as they came from the oven, deeply breathing in the family smells. And then we called my brothers and my sister into the kitchen and my dad, and we sat at our little kitchen table and we ate. Now, I don't think that meal changed anyone's life, not anyone else's at least. It changed mine. It wasn't a miraculous example of proficiency in the kitchen. It wasn't the best lamb or baklava that anyone at the table had ever had, but it changed me, and over the course of the day, I felt like a window had been opened between me and my Greek family. There was more to me, as it had turned out, than just me. I was a part of a heritage, and that meal changed everything.
So, Sam, thank you for the story. Thank you for sharing the story with us and for clearly meaning the story. I just have to know, you walk out one day and you're given a choice between baklava and pickled herring. What's it going to be?
Marcus, do I even have to answer this question?
No.
Baklava. Good okay. Heavens. Yeah. Baklava.
Me too. Sam, thank you for coming.
Oh, it's such a pleasure always. Thanks, Marcus.
Sam Payne, host of the storytelling show The Appleseed on BYU Radio.
Like their Italian cousins across the Aegean, the Greeks make some great olive oil. But who makes the best olive oil? Well, Marcus Smith got one opinion from Johnny Madge, a professional olive oil taster, olive oil competition judge, and ambassador of Italian olive oil. Now, you might think that he'd be biased in Italy's favor, but in fact, he's open-minded, even enthusiastic about some oils produced in the United States and, here's the surprise, New Zealand.
I wouldn't worry so much about the age of the olive oil. What worries me more about olive oils that you find in stores is that quite often they say they're extra virgin and they're not, because they have what we call defects. And the whole concept of defect is something that is also problematic to explain to people. And I'll try again using music to indicate to you what it means. So extra virgin olive oil means olive oil without defect. It's not I like it, you like it, etc., etc. So this is why I came up with the music idea. So if I'm playing the guitar now and you don't like the way I sing, you don't like the song, that is your personal opinion. If the guitar, on the other hand, is out of tune, there is no discussion. And an olive oil that has a defect, we tasters agree, this is out of tune, this olive oil. It's defected. And there are four or five defects that are defined by international law, and us olive oil tasters recognize them. And as soon as we smell or taste an olive oil that has a defect, in a competition, for example, we put a line through the piece of paper where we're writing down the judgment about the olive oil, and we say, this is defected, it is not extra virgin. It is not in the competition. But most importantly of all, in the context of the competition, is that we give feedback to the producer. Because one of the great things about competitions is that we hope that the producers will listen to what we say about their olive oil and learn. So we can tell from smell and taste quite a lot of the time what they screwed up.
But I still don't know what a defect is, or I don't know what causes it other than your judgment. Is there something that you can identify in the process of making it, or in its transportation, or its storage, or its aging that generates a defect?
There are many. When you pick your olives, if you put them on the ground like I did many years ago and leave them there for 10 days, those olives ferment. And when they ferment, they make the olive oil smell and taste of tapenade. You know what I mean? Olive paste.
Yes.
Which is a very pleasant flavor if you're into olive paste. But if you have that in olive oil, it's telling you that the olives fermented. And we don't want that in extra virgin. So there is a technical word for that, which is fusty. So that smell of tapenade, of olive paste, that's one defect. It's confusing because another defect, which has got a word that sounds similar, is musty. And that's when mold grows on the olives before you crush them. And so you get this disgusting, moldy, like a kind of old cellar smell and taste in your olive oil. When you have a musty oil in a competition, it's absolutely vital that you then clean your palate with Granny Smith apple, which is what we use to cleanse our palates when we're getting confused. But the worst defect in terms of lingering, disgusting flavor in your mouth is this musty defect. So these are two defects that happen before you've even started making the olive oil. Then the most disgusting defect of all is called muddy sediment. When you make olive oil, you should, in my mind and in the mind of most experts, filter it after you have made it. Because if you don't, all the tiny little particles of olive that are floating, that are suspended in the olive oil, will eventually settle to the bottom of the tank or bottle that they're in and sit there and end up looking like a kind of brown, muddy sludge. This sediment does not always ferment, but sometimes it does. And when it ferments anaerobically because it's under the oil. There's no oxygen. And it can create the most unbelievable, disgusting smells and tastes. So I'm going to use polite words because we're on radio. But one of the most characteristic smells is manure, which is just a polite word for something else. Vomit, I'm afraid that's what it smells like. And another description is pig farm waste pond.
So am I qualified to identify this smell of muddiness as a neophyte? I mean, could I just put my nose up there and I would recognize and say, well, I've smelled manure before.
If I gave that oil to you, you would get it immediately. I once had a nurse, actually, and she said, okay, I'm getting dead bodies as well. Obviously, there are borderline defects, so that's when you need the experts. Sometimes the defect is very slight, and that's when the experts on a table of four have to agree and come up with an average score of how defected it is to say it's extra virgin or it isn't.
As a consumer in the United States, I go to a store, I go to a grocery, I see labels, 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 and they all seem to have Italian names. And I understand you have an issue with that.
Well, a lot of us do. So what we call a lot of those oils is Italian sounding. So people believe that Italian means best. And a lot of people are under the impression that Italy makes more olive oil than anyone else, and that's completely wrong. Spain makes by far the most amount of olive oil in the world. A lot of those Italian-sounding bottles that you'll see, and I'm not going to name any names, but some of them are very famous, will probably contain a lot of Spanish or North African or Turkish olive oil. The Spaniards made some of the best oil in the world. But because they make so much, they also make a lot of olive oil that is not that great. And the characteristic of badly made Spanish oil is cat pee. So quite often you can pick up a bottle of this so-called Italian oil and you lift it to your nose. You lift a cup of this oil to your nose and smell it. And if you get this kind of sour cat pee smell, you can be sure it's Spanish.
Well, that is not the best calling card now, is it?
No.
Well, I think you have a strong opinion, but not of all. You've definitely smelled and tasted good oils out of Spain?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, in competitions, I think if you really looked at the statistics, Spain would probably be the people who win the most prizes. And I absolutely love Spanish oil. And I'm sitting here in Italy now looking at my, what we call my Manhattan of olive oils. I've got a whole shelf full of olive oils over there. And there must be 6 or 7 Spanish oils there because I love them. The really good ones are spectacular.
Are there any producers in on this side of the globe, North America, South America? Have you tasted any good, high, fine quality oils from out here?
Absolutely. California have some really, really good producers. And some of the producers, for example, I know a woman who mills olive oil in California, and she also judges with me in Japan, and she makes great olive oil. So California has got some very good olive oils. But be very careful, because just as there is stuff that is called, we call Italian-sounding olive oil, there are some olive oils in California which are what I would call California-sounding. Look at the – you're lucky in your country because you have good laws about olive oil. And on the back of the bottle, it will say where that olive oil actually comes from. So it may say California, this, that, and the other on the bottle. But make sure it really is, because maybe on the back it says it's produce of European countries or something like that. As far as South America goes, Chile, Argentina, Peru, these three countries are making great olive oils. Wherever you can grow olives, you can make good oil. And Australia and New Zealand make great oil too.
Johnny Madge is a professional olive oil taster. I'm Tenery Taylor. BYU Radio invites you to join with us and other listeners in 10,000 acts of service. That's our goal, and you can join the effort. For great ideas, we encourage you to go to justserve.org. It's an online resource where you can discover volunteer opportunities right in your own zip code. And we'd love to hear about what you're doing. Living as a nomad is a disappearing way of life. Monday on Constant Wonder, we talk to a nomad from the Somali desert, where fending off lions, hyenas, and wild dogs was all in a day's work.
We live with lions, hyenas, wild dogs, fox. We were at war with those animals, the wild animals. I remember one night we got attacked by a lion, and I remember how my grandmother just, the whole family were screaming. They were holding torch of fire. I was so worried, but I saw her coming back, her body in deep defiance, you know, unharmed. It's just the way she was.
We'll talk to the last nomad Monday on Constant Wonder. You can find us on Sirius XM channel 143 or as a podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.